Welcome to Justice Visions, the podcast about everything that is new in the domain of transitional justice. Justice Visions is hosted at the Human Rights Center of Ghent University. For more information, visit justicevisions.org.
Welcome to this episode of the Justice Visions podcast. I am Tine de Strooper.
And I'm Brigitte Hermans. Today we're talking to Professor Stefan Parmentier and Dr. Rudina Yassini. Welcome. Can we say Rudina and Stefan?
Of course.
With pleasure.
Stefan, you're a professor of criminal law and criminology at the University of Leuven, with a long-standing expertise in transitional justice processes, as well in Latin America as in the Balkans and the Great Lakes region. We're really excited to have you here. Rudina, you are an attorney and a researcher at Oxford University, and you wrote your dissertation on victim participation in the Khmer Rouge Tribunal in Cambodia. Great to also have you in the studio.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you, Brigitte and Tina.
Stefan, Ina, welcome. Thank you for joining us. It's great to have two experts with us today to walk us through the ins and outs of what legal frameworks are when it comes to victim participation in transitional justice.
And in the pilot episode, we actually already talked about the questions that are front and center for the researchers of our team when it comes to victim participation in transitional justice. And we also talked about how transitional justice is almost a catch-all term for a very broad range of processes, and specifically the four pillars: truth-seeking, criminal justice, reparations, and guarantees of non-recurrence.
So we are talking about a vast set of mechanisms in this podcast: tribunals, truth commissions, schemes to restitute land, educational programs, institutional reform, etc.
Right, and because there is such a broad range of instruments, there is also a broad range of ways in which we can think about the role of victims in them. And that's what we want to talk about with you today.
Sure. Maybe just before we start, by means of introduction, I just wanted to briefly ask you what drew you to studying victim participation in transitional justice, and where does your research interest in this matter come from? Stefan, I'll start with you.
Okay, thank you very much. I guess you start because I'm a bit older, so maybe I can have a more historical perspective to this. But I wanted to start with a very personal note. I wrote my first letter on behalf of a victim in an Uruguayan prison when I was 15 years old. And that experience, which at that time I had not foreseen, had enormous consequences for me, because I started to realize I was really interested in human rights. It was the first time that I started to understand what the concept was. This is the 1970s. And of course, many things happened in Latin America at that time: Uruguay, Argentina, Chile, and so on. It's the time of the dictatorships entering. And I got drawn into this particular mode of thinking along those lines and in those days. So I think that's probably my first real recollection of what a human right and what a victim's right could mean at that time. But then later on, from an academic point of view, I studied law and sociology, and I was getting really interested, of course, in the effects of law in society. In fact, I thought that law school was a bit narrow in that sense, because it was very normative and always talking about what people should do, but never asking the question what they actually do and whether law has an impact and in which way it has an impact. And I think that sociolegal perspective for me has been the academic inspirational source to start thinking about the impact, of course, of human rights as well on everyone concerned, all the stakeholders, perpetrators, of course, but also victims.
Thank you. Ina, would you want to elaborate where your interest comes from?
Thank you, Brigitte. Like Stefan, I would like also to start with a personal note. My research with victims of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia started actually in the spring of 2009, when at the time I was pursuing a master's degree at the University of Oxford, and I received an invitation from one of my colleagues from The Hague, with whom I had worked at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, who was involved in representing the first group of victims before the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia. I jumped on this opportunity, and I worked with the legal team representing victims for 2 months in Cambodia, in Phnom Penh. What I found at the time, particularly coming from an experience with the legal defense at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, where you felt disconnected from the victim stories. You saw them always present in the courtroom as witnesses, but you were never close enough to relate or build a rapport and listen to their stories. As part of the work with victims in Cambodia, I met with a group of victims. Actually, the first group meeting was in a pagoda, which for most of the victims that had come to represent a meeting point of the survivors and also a place where to honor the memory of those lost. The man sitting in front of me, who was 15 at the time of the Khmer Rouge, had lost 35 members of his family. And his words of pain and sorrow reverberated across the hallowed space of this pagoda, but also reverberated across my mind and brought the victim's pain and grief ever so close. And this was in a way a symbolic moment, because it came to represent to me that quite often the justice rendered in the premises of The Hague or other tribunals had not necessarily been received and perceived as such by victims and communities in post-conflict societies.
Thank you both so much for sharing that experience. And I think that really also touches upon the reason why we invited the two of you, because you both have that legal background, but also really that practice-oriented perspective and experience. And yet what we wanted to do in this episode is precisely, before we dive into the nitty-gritty of what victim participation looks like on the ground, to really take a step back and consider what the legal framework for victim participation is in these various transitional justice mechanisms.
Yes, because of course the role of victims can be as light as consulting them and as far-reaching as having victims have the final voice in, for example, determining a reparation scheme. But what becomes clear immediately is that there are a lot of these instruments and innovations. In your opinions, what is the most important legal instrument to guarantee victims' rights in the context of transitional justice? And why do you consider it so important?
I would say that although victim participation at an international level, international criminal justice level, is perceived as this new, a novel advancement, but it's greatly reflected in the parallel advancement in both domestic and international. And it was part of a broad movement that saw the marginalization of victims within the criminal justice system. And I would mention two legal instruments that came to be crucial and important upon which various tribunals have built on their statute and law, as well as the legal framework, more specifically on victim participation. The first one is the 1986, the UN United Nations Declarations for Victims of Crime which and Abuse of Power, which for all practical purposes was considered with a focus on domestic of crimes. And then in 2006, we had another United Nations declaration, a very important one, with a focus on victims of international crimes, which focused more specifically on the right to remedy, as well as the right to reparation. This was a momentous development with regard to the victims on both domestic and international. Other than that, what we have seen with regard to the application of the victim participation mechanism in international criminal courts and tribunals, which are hybrid and sui generis in nature, I would argue that victim participation has acted more as experiment in laboratories and not guided by strong, careful principles and legal normative principles to guide the process of application in practice.
Okay, we'll come back to that later because it's a key point, but maybe you would want to give your take.
Well, it couldn't have been said better than that, because indeed these were the two legal instruments I was thinking of myself. First, going back to the 1985. Then Declaration of for Victims of Crime and Abuse of Power. I've tried to identify four main rights that actually derive from that declaration. One is the right to information for victims. The second is the right to standing in legal procedures. The third one is the right to reparation. And the fourth one is the right to support. Because, of course, also during procedures and pre and after, victims need support, often for the kinds of issues they go through, whether it's traumatization that has happened before or even during proceedings. And I think these are really the milestones in a certain way, of course, at a domestic level, as Ina was saying. But I would like to suggest that We always go back to that initial declaration, and at the same time, because it's 1985, it may sound very strange because the Universal Declaration goes back to 1948. What happened in those 40 years with victims? In fact, they were nowhere. Human rights have often been considered as rights of the accused or the suspects. But if you look at victims, strangely enough, they are a recently invented category or recently discovered category. And that in itself, I think, is very worthwhile to consider because, of course, it's not without mobilization of many victims groups around the world that this declaration has taken root. And then a number of other legal instruments, also some binding ones in the Council of Europe and in the European Union, have seen the light of day.
I find that very interesting what you say about, you know, where for 40 years almost there was this gap, this non-attention. And then you're also referring to the mobilization of victims groups themselves actually in facilitating that this was all of a sudden on the agenda. How do you understand that sudden attention? Why were they all of a sudden successful, these victims organizations, in indeed putting that on the agenda and getting these declarations, these instruments adopted at that international level?
There could be a number of issues or a number of arguments there, a number of factors that have played a role. I can see at least two, but one is, I think, exactly what happened in Latin America in the 1970s. Think of Argentina, think of Chile. In 1975 and 76, sorry, and 73, respectively, the juntas are taking root. And then, of course, victims start to organize themselves immediately. Basically, immediately. It was not easy, of course. They were in the midst of a very authoritarian regime, very strong state power. But many of them either stayed in the country or were banned and exiled and then started to form victims groups in Europe, in other countries of Latin America, sometimes in the United States. Then, on the other hand, I see this development of international scientific organizations. And if I'm not mistaken, in the early 1980s, or even a little bit before that, there is the establishment of the World Society of Victimology. Now, the name itself is telling because it's all about victims' rights and needs and the interest for victims. And it was really like a joint venture, I would say, between victims groups, grassroots organizations, but very vocal and very well educated and well professionalized on the one hand, and then the academics who were interested in providing more input and more visibility for the victims. And then so you see these drafts going back and forth about the importance of coming to a declaration. Of course, it's a non-binding instrument in those days, but still it sets the scene because it's a starting point for a stronger and longer development also in regional systems in Europe and other parts of the world.
Stefan, the principles that you've just mentioned have celebrated their 50th birthday this year. A lot has changed since they were adopted. Are there also elements in the guidelines that we should be skeptical of, or places where they may be too limited in scope? Based on what we know today, is there room for improvement, Ina?
Well, I mean, definitely, I think the empirical work and the application in practice have given us enough understanding of how to further process and shape victim participation. And this needs to be reflected also in the legal instruments. And you have to start with the main legal foundations. That would be my main reflection, I would say, although we are still in this experimental stage, we have seen it with the ICC, the ECCC, Special Tribunal for Lebanon, and also the new Kosovo Specialist Chambers, which has given the most general definition of victim participation we have come to see thus far. Therefore, I think we need to reflect and enshrine these new ideas and principles in the legal instruments.
I want to pause for a moment on this notion of definitions that you're just touching upon, because we're talking about all these various legal instruments. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on whether in these different legal instruments we see different interpretations of who is considered a victim, but also of what is considered meaningful participation. And I'm maybe also going to look at you, Stefan, because you also worked on these various instruments. Do you see any conflicting notions there?
First of all, I see lots of congruence, let's say, similarity. Similarity between, on the one hand, victims of crime, let's say ordinary crime at the domestic level, that's 1985, and then 2005-06, victims of international crimes. In fact, they are called victims of serious violations of human rights and humanitarian law. So the notion of international crime hardly figures in the basic principles. But despite these very fundamentally different focuses, domestic, ordinary crime, international crime, mostly, let's say, international, at the supranational level, I see a lot of congruence, because basically it's about victimhood, victimization, the rights of victims, and a little bit about the needs of victims. I would probably say that the needs are a bit snowed under in these legal instruments, and probably because of that, because they're legal instruments, and it's much more difficult to legalize a need than it is to legalize a right. That's one thing. The other part is that I see these both instruments, in fact, finding the way in binding documents, because, in fact, both of them are non-binding. They're declarations, which seems to suggest a very soft, you know, you could go in different directions, interpreting them and what have you. And this goes to what Ina said, that, of course, the interpretation becomes then very important, and who deals with it and who gives substance to them. And the substance is being given by various bodies, including non-legal bodies like General Assemblies and what have you, parliaments and institutions like those, but also like courts. And in fact, what you see is a slow, gradual development of legalization of these non-binding instruments into the case law of specific courts. The two strongest courts at the regional level, at least, are the European Court on the one hand, and the Inter-American Courts.
Rudina, I would like you to tell us a bit more about the provisions for victim participation in the specific case of the Khmer Rouge Tribunal and how it compares to other DJ instruments.
In fact, the participation of victims of the Khmer Rouge at the extraordinary chambers in the courts of Cambodia build on this strong definition of victim participation that came with ICC, which was a very strong base, although this is a different tribunal, operates within a specific context. But the ICC or the Rome Treaty laid the way, I guess, for this development that we have seen as a trend now in international criminal justice. In the case of Cambodia, what I would mention first and foremost is that victim participation was an afterthought. It was not a forethought that was carefully analyzed and thought from the very beginning. I would say that the framers of this institution had realized quite late in the process that, oh, here we have now this new mechanism that was mentioned in the agreement and the statute, and therefore now we have to give some scope. In the first case, which was the case against Doik, the infamous director of S21 prison in Phnom Penh, you had 96 victims initially that were recognized and granted the status of civil parties, who were represented by four legal teams, were all pro bono. So you did not have an harmonious approach to victim legal representation for victims.
Actually, we talked earlier this month to Sangeeta Yogendran, who is a former practitioner at the court at the victim support section. So let's maybe listen to what she had to say about this point.
The Khmer Rouge Tribunal began its victim participation scheme with really high aspirations, as you just mentioned. And I think a lot of the victims who were signing up as civil parties came into the process with equally high aspirations. Unfortunately, I think the reality on the ground was that due to the high numbers signing up to be civil parties and the need for some level of efficiency before the tribunal itself, what you see is that perhaps participation became a bit more tokenistic, unfortunately. You see a situation where a lot of victims were signing up to participate as individuals, but due to the high numbers, and I think in case two, we're talking about more than 4,000 civil parties signing up, you saw them ending up being grouped in quite large groups of victims who were then represented by their own civil party lawyers. And all those civil party lawyers were then represented by a national, international co-lead lawyer. So what you see is you perhaps have lost some of that substance in the participation because now victims were being represented on one level by their lawyers and then again removed by another level with their co-lead lawyers.
This comes to a very important principle. The idea of victim participation is to allow victims to have a different forum than that of a witness, to allow them to tell their story, which in the context of a criminal trial is always very confined. Also, it is important to remember that the testimony of a civil party doesn't necessarily carry the same weight as the testimony of a witness. All in all, can we allow 4,000 victims to have a say in a courtroom? Not really. Whoever is chosen to tell a story should not be seen as a representation of all the victims that have been recognized or granted the right as civil parties. I could add one thing. As part of the empirical research I conducted in Cambodia, where I interviewed 52 victims who had participated in civil parties in the first case and the second case. And the primary purpose of the interviews is to understand what are the motivations that lie behind victims' participation. Yeah, one element is that I think much of victims' understanding about their participation is shaped by the information by human rights organization in Cambodia that had prepared the terrain. And secondly, to understand what victims want. And there are different opinions, but there were, in my research, six primary motivations. Truth, seeking truth, was perhaps the most paramount of all of them. Facing the accused, seeking justice, our understanding of justice, and here we have to take into consideration the sociocultural and religious nuances, was not necessarily linked only with pursuing a guilty verdict of the accused. It was much broader, the idea of justice, which links also with the idea of the reconciliation. And reparation was perhaps the most critical, disappointing aspect of victim participation, which is a characteristic of not only Cambodia, but I would say of most victims who have participated or are continuously participating at the ICC and other courts.
But then if I understand you correctly, in the first part of what you just said, you also seem to be implying an a priori incompatibility between victim participation and the forum of a criminal justice process. Stefan, is that also something that you see, that tension there?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The tension is always there. In fact, you also see it at a domestic level, where victims think that they can really speak more and express more and gain more from processes, whether it's very serious crime cases or even ordinary crime cases. But at the international level, it's even more prominent, I think, because you have many more victims. And of course, the capacity of many of those systems is very limited. They're often depending on external funding, provisional funding. Very few institutions have a permanent mandate, and even if they have that kind of mandate, they're still very much constrained in terms of financial resources. So the tension, I think, is always there, and I very much agree with Ina that it has to do a lot with the expectations. And everyone involved, every stakeholder involved, in my view, should really look more carefully into the preparations of all of these mechanisms, or let's say of the role of victims in all of these mechanisms. It is Pablo de Graaf, our well-known colleague at New York University and former special rapporteur on transitional justice, who has been insisting so much every time again on the necessity of managing victim expectations. And I think it becomes even more important as there are new truth commissions being set up and new tribunals, like the Kosovo one more recently, or even like the Lebanon one, which has not produced any single person to come forward, let's say, or to be brought to court. But it's very important to tell victims what they can expect in the specific forums. And the lack of preparation or the lack of clarity in relation to those forums, I think, generates a lot of frustration and a lot of disappointment. And at the end of certain international or even national prosecutions, because, of course, there are also national prosecutions in the field of international crimes, leaves victims sometimes with empty hands and with a double victimization, with a re-victimization, because not only have they been victimized materially or physically before, or psychologically often, of course, but in their hopes to receive redress or reparation in a tangible or non-tangible way are also quashed. And that is even more problematic. They lose their faith in the systems and in the institutions, and that may have a tremendous impact on the role of victims in society later on, whether they're still able and willing to be part of society, how they can function, how they can be citizens again, how they can participate in political institutions or in social life or in economic activities. I mean, if you've been traumatized and re-traumatized so many times, then it becomes increasingly difficult to assume a proper role as an ordinary, let's say a common, but also a proper citizen. And I think it the ramifications of this victim gap, one could even say, some call it the deficiency or the tensions, but tensions is actually too soft of a word in this case, are the consequences of all of this are yet to be seen. So I'm a bit concerned that also victim organizations or human rights organizations or lawyers or whomever, even the courts themselves or governments, are just putting too much emphasis on the possibility for victims to be actively involved, while in reality they are not, for whatever reasons, for constraints, institutional, financial, but also because the sheer numbers, of course, are extremely difficult to manage.
Do you see any best practices when it actually comes to victim participation, specifically in criminal justice? Because we are now talking about criminal justice. Of course, there's victim participation also in truth commissions and in other forms of memorialization. But when it comes specifically to criminal justice, do we see any examples where things have actually worked out in a way?
That's a hard one.
It is a hard one, and I would say that some of us started the work and research in this field with the enthusiasm, believing that there can be a different approach to international criminal justice where victims are made to feel they are stakeholders in the process. But when you look close to the way it is applied, you understand that maybe we need to reconsider what are the best possible ways for victims to feel involved in a transitional justice mechanism. And I make this a little bit broader because another aspect that is not very much discussed about is, in addition to victims that have been granted the status as civil parties, let's take the context of Cambodia. We have 1.7 to 2 million people. We have to think of victims who have not been granted status. And we have to look at the bigger picture, that are we trying to accommodate the interests of victims as a whole, or are we here to adjust the expectations of a group of people, even though 4,000 it's a big number, it's a huge group. So there is, on a several layers, so I see it much more as a multi-layered or multi-layered challenges to victim participation. And to say whether there are any best practices, it's hard to say. I think we're still in that experimental stage. We have to see. We don't even know yet, and there needs to be some studies, I guess, hopefully soon, to measure what have been the impacts.
We wanted to ask you a last question that we ask all of our interviewees. What are for you the most pressing questions, and where do we need to start looking for answers?
Yes, that's an easy question. Multi-million dollar question, I would say. Actually, I know an interesting project which ERC funding at the University of Ghent that could provide some of those answers, but maybe in a couple of years from now. Well, there are a couple of things which I would like to suggest that we look into more carefully. One is, as Ina was suggesting already, victims are actually very different in terms of their needs. The rights may be similar, but the specific needs that they have may be very different. Moreover, needs are changing over time. And I think we need to look more into the depth of victims' needs. Right, to talk about rights is a legal language, but to talk about needs is a social language. And I think we haven't really covered not even the surface of trying to understand how these two fit together, mm-hmm. the rights discourse and the needs discourse. And as long as that is not done, it's going to be extremely difficult to even make progress in terms of accommodating institutions to the needs of victims. Mm-hmm. And I would say probably the best way to deal with victims' needs and rights is to prevent violations to happen altogether. Now, that, of course, is maybe seemingly so easy, but it is actually in the victim reparations guidelines, because it's that famous fifth category, which nobody really has a good idea about, the guarantees of non-recurrence, of non-repetition. If you look at it in more detail, it's actually changing the world. Literally, it's changing society in all different kinds of ways. But that is something which cannot be done in legal ways only. I mean, law has a function, law has a mandate, but as Pablo de Grave in one of his reports was arguing, it also needs institutional input, it needs social input, cultural, economic, political. So this is really broadening up a new arena, and the focus on prevention in the long run seems to be more promising than always running behind institutions which are dealing to a certain mm-hmm. extent with the past but will never be able to satisfy victims' needs and even have a hard time to satisfy victims' rights.
Ina, what are the most pressing issues for you?
I echo entirely the thoughts of Stefan here. This is a major area to discuss. It's multidimensional, multi-layered. I've come to an understanding based on my, I would say, limited research on victim participation, and I'm still working on it, that we need a concerted effort when it comes to victims' involvement in a post-conflict society. Courts are fraught with limitations, legal and procedural. We expect too much from international criminal tribunals. Sometimes we have these broad and overriding objectives, such as truth, accountability, reconciliation, reparation, all in all too much for a court with a primary focus on establishing accountability. That's the reason why the courts have been established for. And then we add this other important element, that is the victim participation. But from the context, a more narrow understanding, if we have a victim participation, then we have to have first a clear definition who the victim is. Secondly, very clear legal procedural foundations, statute, law, rules of procedures, and evidence. And third, what does participation look like mm-hmm. in trial? And fourth, importantly, what does it live up to? And it should start first and foremost, and coming back to what Stefan said, needs. If we have a good understanding of needs, maybe we will tailor and shape up a system that allows victims to accommodate victims' needs. And that's paramount, I would say.
There's a lot of inspiration there, inspiration both for a new and needed, I think, research agenda, but also in a very concrete sense. I feel that there's a lot of stuff there to talk about in our next episodes of the podcast. So I want to thank you both so much for so beautifully laying the groundwork for all these topics that we will still talk about in the next episodes. Next time we talk to Laurel Fletcher of Berkeley's Human Rights Center, precisely about that evolution of transitional justice as both a legal discipline and a field of practice. So thank you so much for setting the seed for that as well.
With pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Absolute pleasure.
This was Justice Visions. To re-listen to this episode or to browse our archive, visit our website, justicevisions.org, or subscribe now via Spotify or Apple Music. Justice Visions is made possible through generous funding of the European Research Council. The podcast is produced by Katharina Smets. You heard the voices of Tina De Strupa, Brigitte Herremans, and our studio guests.